But what we're doing today, Ben, really has potentially profound implications for generations to come. That's why it's so very important for each of us to become more cognizant of where we are in time, where we are in the Anthropocene era, what the potential implications for not acting are, what the potential implications are for not acting enough.
That was Daniel Wagner, and this is episode 17 of the All Things Risk podcast. Welcome back to the All Things Risk podcast. My name is Ben Cattaneo. I am your host. This is my show. I'm the creator of the All Things Risk podcast. I'm also the scheduler, the editor, the only interviewer, the marketer, many other things. I do it as a labor of love. Thank you for joining me. It's great to have you with me. If you've been here before, you know that this is a show about risk and uncertainty across all domains, all aspects of life. And I go long form conversation with my guests, some very interesting people. And the reason why I do this is because in addition to being interesting and insightful, I think we can all benefit from taking risks with a little bit more intelligence, perhaps a little bit more elegance, and we could all learn and manage and even thrive in eras of high uncertainty. Today, I'm very pleased to have a first. So this is my first guest reappearance on the show. My guest today is Daniel Wagner. And if you listen to episode 10, you know that he is the CEO of a company called Country Risk Solutions. And in that episode, we talked geopolitics, we talked career paths, all kinds of things. But today we go bigger picture than that. And Daniel joins me in person here in London. Of course, Daniel is an expert in country risk, but he's also an author, and his latest book, which he co-wrote with Dante Disparte, is out now, and it is called Global Risk Agility and Decision Making: Organizational Resilience in the Era of Man-Made Risk. It is, I think, a very timely and extremely important book that talks about why we need to bring the whole discipline and thinking of managing risk into the 21st century. The book received some wonderful reviews by some very prominent individuals. You can check out the website globalriskagility.com for a little bit more info on that. But for organizations, it's all about treating risk and risk agility as a catalyst for growth. And what that means is an entire paradigm shift, bringing risk into the core of doing things. And I think there are some lessons here for individuals as well. But if we talk about businesses, it means that businesses need to think and act in very different ways than what many are doing now. And it's fascinating stuff. It's very important, and it, I think, created a conversation that you'll really enjoy. We talk about a number of things. Now, I would be a little bit remiss if I didn't tap into Daniel's expertise on country risk. So we did that at the beginning, talking about Brexit. Brexit has affected the UK, certainly, and I took advantage of having Daniel on the show to get his view. So we did talk about that, but then we transitioned into the themes of the book, the era of man-made risk. That means human-created risk, and what's different about that, things like climate change, cybersecurity, terrorism, and how organizations need to start responding to all of this, the difficulties, the challenges with traditional approaches to risk management. So things like short-termism and greed, and what it really means to be risk agile. We have a great conversation about, and this is going to sound a little bit woo-woo, but it isn't, organizations having a conscience. Maybe woo-woo is the wrong word, a little bit hippie-ish, which we talk about. It's not. It is incredibly important. And the book talks a lot about this and the importance of organizations doing, quote unquote, doing the right thing. Sounds easy, incredibly hard to do. We talk about some of the systemic issues and overcoming some of those challenges. We get into things like corruption, a fascinating conversation about the role of boards in organizations and some insights. We talk about disruption. We talk about political systems. We talk about some of the trends that are going on now about politics and society. So things like the Trump phenomenon, Rodrigo Duterte, the president of the Philippines, and what's happening there, and some of the big picture changes that are occurring that we need to take note of. Individual and organizational leadership and the need for simplicity and common sense, and loads more. It's a great conversation. As I said, this is a very important book. This will give you some interesting insights and a bit of a taste of what that book is like. I hope that you enjoy it. I certainly had a wonderful time having this conversation with Daniel. Ladies and gentlemen, here's Daniel Wagner. And you are my second time guest.
Oh,
so this will be episode 16, or no, this will be episode 17 or something like that.
Lucky
so
number 17.
First time that I've had somebody come back. So
well,
that's great.
Let's hope there's a reason for it.
But very appropriate that I think you're here post the Brexit vote. And I've always said to my audience, I don't want to date these episodes, but I think we'd be a little remiss without talking about Brexit a little bit, but perhaps from a more strategic, longer-term perspective. I voted Remain. I actually got the vote out for Remain, or tried to. And as it stands now, at the time that we're doing this, it feels pretty morose around here, as in London. You have a different take on the EU, and your comment to me was that the EU is a failed experiment, and it could be a while before we see all of that played out, but I'd be very interested in your take on the longer term prospects for the EU, why you think that.
Sure. Well, as you know, I'm not eligible to vote on that particular subject, mm-hmm. but if I was, I would have voted to leave for mm-hmm. a very simple reason. And in my view, it's a pluses versus minuses mm-hmm. calculation. You know, are the perceived pluses outweighing mm-hmm. the minuses? And my belief is that the leave vote won simply because more and more people think that mm. the calculation is no longer in Britain's favor. If I was a country, I would think, you know, do I really want someone else telling me exactly how I can operate my military overseas, exactly how many hoops I have to jump through in order to sell goods abroad, et cetera, et cetera. When everybody's doing it, you think, well, we're all in the same playing pen, so what's the difference? But the UK's in a very unique position, I think. First of all, very few European countries are as well poised to compete internationally as the UK is. I mean, France and Germany come to mind. But that said, I'm also mindful that the UK got along just fine for 17 centuries being independent. Mm-hmm. And if it's hitched its wagon to the EU for 40 years, well, that's a very small period of time compared to the overall history of the country. And I just think that the reason that I say that the EU is a failed experiment is there are so many things that were not foreseen, mm-hmm. so many things that have been unaccounted for. They never imagined that there was going to be a problem and that people were going to want to leave. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing how difficult a prospect that mm-hmm. may turn out to be.
So what kind of problems, for instance, are you talking about the euro and the difficulties of creating a monetary and fiscal union and a political union effectively to have a fiscal policy that everyone agrees with?
I look at it this way, Ben. And maybe the analogy isn't quite appropriate, mm-hmm. but I don't think it was appropriate to carve Iraq into a country because mm-hmm. of its unique qualities, and yet mm-hmm. that's exactly what was done about a century ago. I also think it was similarly unrealistic to imagine that 27 distinct countries with lots of languages and lots of history and lots of cultural differences are all going to be one happy family getting along. It's a nice concept. If it works well, that's great. It's one of the world's largest economies, one of the world's largest populations, etc. But I just think when you talk about 27 different countries, how realistic was that to begin with? And it turns out that there were so many things that were unanticipated that I just think its creators were unrealistic.
Interesting. Well, we may see its unraveling, or we may see what I think, at least short term, and what I mean by short term is the next 2 to 3 years is going to be a painful set of years for this country and the region. I'm hopeful that longer term it will turn out better, but at the moment it's feeling like we're entering a period of a huge amount of pain, self-inflicted perhaps.
Let me just add, Ben, if I may, I think the UK has less to worry about than Europe as a whole, and we'll know in relatively short order if there are other countries that are going to act on their nationalistic impulses and their potential to exit. I think there will be unintended consequences here in the UK, and I think that's really what concerns a lot of people. But at the end of the day, in the long term, I would say Europe has much more to worry about than the UK.
Okay, interesting. We'll see how that plays out. One of the things, and maybe you can transition into your book in a moment, so Global Risk Agility, that is very interesting. I've actually, there is a petition going around for a second referendum vote at the moment. And we'll see how that plays out again, at the time of writing. There's another petition, so I didn't sign that one. There is one, however, that I did sign that was around making London a city-state. And
you mean Londonistan?
Yeah, Londonistan, yes. I mean London. I like the concept of the city-state. And if Nassim Taleb's book, The Black Swan and Anti-Fragile, he actually talks about how a world of city-states would be much more preferable to a world of nation-states, because city-state could kind of collapse, but it doesn't really send the whole world tumbling down. The concept appeals to me. We can transition a little bit around, traditional... So your book is about bringing traditional approaches of risk into the 21st century. So maybe first be great to get your summary of what that book is all about. What inspired you to write it? And we can maybe get into some of the meat of it, perhaps.
Well, before we dive into that, maybe I'll just say a word about city-states.
Sure.
I had the privilege of living in the world's premier city-state, Singapore, for 3 years, which was a terrific experience. And, I think Singapore proves that it can be done very, very well indeed for an area that has a lot of handicaps. It doesn't have its own natural resources or its own food sources, etc.
Yeah.
By the same token, we should be very mindful of not getting too isolationist in too many different areas. If London were to ever become a city-state, which of course it will not, but if it were, I think it would be, again, unrealistic to imagine that it's going to be just existing off by itself, and it's not going to be surrounded by a country, and it's not going to have an impact on anyone else. So that's one issue. I also, on this petition issue, if I could just give my two cents
yes,
worth for that. It sort of reminds me of someone who says, well, let's have this one-time vote, and assuming it goes my way, then we don't need a revote. But if it doesn't go my way, we're going to need a revote.
Absolutely.
How about 2 out of 3?
Yes.
I mean, the Prime Minister was very clear.
Yes.
This is a one-shot deal.
That's
and
right.
It does seem to me, no offense, to be a bit of sour grapes. I'm sorry about that.
I agree with you. As I said, I haven't signed that petition. My take on it now is the deed is done, and we need to rip the bandage off.
And there were a lot of people, apparently, whether they exist or not, who maybe didn't even exist, right?
Yeah.
They had people signing it from all over the world, including you know, the Vatican and places where the votes
North Korea had a big chunk of
right, and the votes themselves exceeded the population of the proposed venues. So, it all seems very silly
to me. Yeah, but, yeah. Okay. We'll see how that plays out.
But what inspired me to write the book? So I have a co-author. His name is Dante Desparte. The book was actually his idea. Again, it's called Global Risk Agility and Decision Making. That's the full title. And he basically said, look, we're in a unique era. We're in a unique time. And there's nothing out there in the literature that's talking about the importance of risk managers and decision makers getting in front of man-made risk. What do I mean by that? Climate change, cyber risk, terrorism, things like that. For a long time, what's happened is that a lot of business people, nation states, organizations of all kinds have sort of figured, well, you know what? These are someone else's problems. Mm-hmm. Floods, they happen in Bangladesh. Mm. They don't happen in my town or in my country. And we've seen that when it comes to all of the three topics that I just mentioned, they're everybody's problem now, right? Cyber risk. How many people have had their identity stolen? How many times have you had to reset your password because of a hack? Mm. It's affecting you on that level. Climate change, of course, affects us all. Droughts, heat, cyclones, etc. And terrorism is everyone's problem. It's no longer the Middle East. It's no longer a failed state's problem. Mm. It's on everyone's doorstep. And so that's why we thought it was rather important to write this book. Nothing to our knowledge has been written about it to date. And part of the core message here is it doesn't matter who you are and what you do. Mm-hmm. These things need to become part of your core thinking going forward. And the reason we say this for organizations is that the subtitle of the book is How to Achieve Organizational Resiliency in the 21st Century. If organizations can't be resilient, they don't last. If they don't last, well, you know what happens. Resiliency also has some different implications. It used to be if you were profitable, you would inevitably be resilient. It's not that anymore. Right. It's not just about achieving profits. You achieve profits in large part if you get ahead of these types of events. And we're talking about a sea change in terms of how people think about risk more generally. Mm-hmm. That's a really important part of the book.
Okay. Could we maybe start with what's the problem with, as you describe it, traditional approaches to risk management?
In the context of what we're talking about here, traditional approaches are reactive. Mm. Traditional approaches don't include risk managers necessarily in the decision-making process. Mm-hmm. So the risk managers should not be the ones who are sent out for the biscuits when the decisions are made. That time is past. Mm. They should be front and center, sitting at the table in the boardroom with the people who are making decisions, and they themselves need to be extremely well informed. Mm-hmm. Being extremely well informed does not mean, oh, I just read the latest report, I feel like I know. No. You have to dive deep into the weeds on this stuff. You have to think in a very critical fashion. You have to be forward thinking. And in the presentations that I've started doing for the book, I actually show a photograph of someone who you might mistake for being an athlete, in terms of he's almost ready to, you know, begin his race. You know, his hands are in front of him. He's looking up and he's looking forward and he's poised to dash ahead, right? And there are obstacles in his way. That, to me, if it is the vision of an athlete, it's also the vision of an organization and people inside the organization who are tasked with the sorts of things I'm talking about. You can't just, if you will, devour everything in your path or push everything that's in your way out of your way. You have to thoughtfully, mindfully address each and every obstacle and do it in such a way that positions you well to be able to do so even better in the future.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So if we could just talk about perhaps, maybe we can dive into one or more of these kinds of man-made risks. So climate change, you know, for example, it's probably one that is very real to people because, you know, we deal with the weather obviously all the time. Mm-hmm. It seems like we've had flooding here in the UK. My own family or extended in-laws in the Philippines dealt with Typhoon Haiyan very directly, and What are some of the ways in which climate change is changing the narrative, the way that people need to be thinking about risk?
That's a great question. First of all, let me say, speaking of Typhoon Haiyan, which for those who don't recognize it, was the most powerful typhoon ever to make landfall in recorded history. That was in 2013. Mm. That typhoon is on the front cover of the book for a very deliberate reason, because it had such an impact on people and the way we're starting to think about typhoons and other weather occurrences. I'll say a couple of things about that. It's a very broad subject, yes. So let me just say this. If you think about how the weather used to impact the oceans, mm-hmm. right? How man-made risk used to impact the temperature of the oceans. Mm-hmm. One of the things we have in the book is a chart which shows from the National Oceanographic and NOAA, I'm getting the rest of the acronym, from the U.S. It shows from 150 years or so in the 1800s through to about 2010, the temperature of the oceans. Mm. And it shows that even after the industrial era, which ended in the 1830s, 1840s, the temperature of the oceans went down. It started going up in about 1910, and between 1910 and 2010, it went up about 1 degree centigrade. Mm. Now, think about that in terms of the COP21, which happened in Paris last mm-hmm. year. Mm-hmm. Everyone was congratulating themselves on how 195 countries have gotten together mm-hmm. and signed this mm-hmm. great platform for hopefully getting a handle on climate change going forward. Mm-hmm. The problem is, yeah, it's great that they all got together. That's mm-hmm. never happened before. The problem is that they're congratulating themselves for what exactly? Mm-hmm. There are no binding elements to that treaty. Mm-hmm. It's totally voluntary. The targets that they created for that treaty, I think, aren't nearly robust enough. They want to limit future rises in ocean temperatures to 2 degrees. 2 degrees, right? In 50 years, it went up 1 degree in 100. And if you think about what would happen if it did rise 2 degrees in the next 50 years, the World Bank, among others, have come out with projections. The OECD has put projections in place that show by 2070, many of the world's coastal cities, many of those coastal cities being financial centers like London and mm-hmm. Tokyo and New York, mm-hmm. could be flooded if things continue the way they're continuing. And if we're really going to do something to avoid such a calamity like that, that's within many of our lifetimes, mm-hmm. certainly that of our children and their children to come, if we're going to do something about that, we have to be far more aggressive than we're being, far less self-congratulatory, mm-hmm. and far more realistic about what the risks are. If we don't get a handle on this now, it's going to be unstoppable. And so while some people would have said, you know, 10, 15 years ago, Al Gore is, you know, a fearmonger or yes. an alarmist, well, a lot of what he's predicted has already come true. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I'm very concerned about that particular topic. In addition, to answer your question, some of the other ramifications. Think about shortages of water. When people mm-hmm. don't have water, what do? They migrate. Mm-hmm. And so it impacts migration patterns. And it's not just from political change that that happens. A lot of people are migrating in and out of the Middle East mm-hmm. because there's just no water, or there's less access to mm-hmm. water. Imagine what will happen in the Northern Hemisphere, in developed countries, should that kind of thing persist, right? It seems so wacky, so totally out of possibility, but it is within reach. And these are the sorts of scenarios that we all need to be thinking about. People can maybe label us as fanning flames or being a little bit alarmist, but what we do is we look at the science, and the statistics don't lie. Mm-hmm. That's good enough argument for me.
So what are some of the approaches then to deal with this that we haven't really thought of? It strikes me one of the problems is it's a problem of incentives, and you know, as so, you know, financial center, for example, right, you know, JP Morgan is one stakeholder that could be badly affected, but they would have to work with the local authorities and all kinds of bodies. It's a collective problem, and the more people that are involved in a solution, the more challenging it is, the more difficult it is to get anything done.
Well, think about it this way. If on an individual, as well as a corporate, as well as a governmental level, this particular topic was to become a priority, we could actually start turning the ship around. What if each of us started saying, you know what, I haven't recycled, but I'm going to start recycling? Or what if each of us said, you know what, I don't actually need that bag to carry my sandwich to the office? You know, that sort of thing. It sounds silly in a way, but if billions of people do it, small things like that can make a difference. And I'm very mindful about it. I've been very mindful about it as an individual. I know that some corporate entities are doing it because it might be perceived as being the politically correct thing to do. Fine, I don't care if that's the reason that you're doing it. Just do it. As far as the governments are concerned, I would feel a lot better if those CRP 195 governments would have said, you know what, I'm not going to sign this because we haven't gone far enough. If they're not doing it just to be able to say that they've done it, or doing it because everyone else seems to be doing it. You know, there are some countries which have taken a far more serious approach on it and did it many years ago. We can learn a lot from them. And a lot of what you might end up reading in the book, you might say, well, this is common sense. And you know what? You would be right. It is common sense to want to get out ahead of this issue at this particular juncture. And it shouldn't just be for the benefit of future generations. It should be for the kind of quality of life we're going to have today. Now, all that said, this is a book about organizational resilience, right? So how do you fight the good fight? You fight the good fight by saying, I'm looking at myself in the mirror and I'm saying, I don't like what I see, and I'm going to do something about it.
Can we talk about resilience then a little bit? And it's a term in my podcast, I've had actually quite a lot of people talk about it from a individual level, from an organizational level, and it's a bit of a buzzword now in terms of what it actually means. And we in my day job we talk about it. What does it mean? How do you address it in the book?
What it means to us is being able to address the unanticipated and the unforeseen. And that's on a very broad spectrum. So many organizations, and I'm talking both public and private sector, are so focused on the short term, and they're so focused on the bottom line. That doesn't really achieve resilience in my book.
You said something interesting at the beginning when we started to talk about this, that being profitable is not what being resilient is all about. In fact, it might be an outcome of...
Or it might be exactly the wrong thing to be focused on at a given point in time. So in the insurance business, which I'm a graduate of, depending on the line of insurance you were in, you had to report your numbers on a weekly basis, right? And people were really, really focused on what is that weekly, monthly, quarterly, annual number? Yeah, that's not unimportant. But do you really get to the finish line the way you want to, simply being focused on what about strategy? Right? What about competition? What about long-term planning? All of these things seem to get lost in the maze sometimes. So resilience, as we're talking about it, is a combination of all of this stuff. It's having the future orientation, having a realistic approach, being self-critical, looking in the mirror, asking the right questions, and making it, your credo as an organization. It's not a short-term approach. It's a permanent change in how we think about not only getting to the finish line, but as we say at the end of the book, it's about survival. That's what the 21st century is about. Not just getting to the finish line, but about surviving.
I see a lot of organizations, and you read a lot about organizations. I mean, we can talk about one of them, Volkswagen, that you discuss, in which... There's a problem of incentives, right? So perverse incentives, short-termism. Absolutely, you see a lot of organizations where let's do everything we can to meet the numbers at the end of the quarter, and then the first few weeks of the next quarter, it's sort of like, oh shit, we booked all those sales last quarter, or we billed all those hours, last quarter. Now what do we do? And then the same problem comes up again, at the end of the quarter, you get the frantic activity. And that's no way to live. If you think about your own, it's kind of like living paycheck to paycheck, right? Mm-hmm. Individually, where, day one after you get your salary, you're off, partying or going out to dinners, and then towards the end you're and a lot of people are doing that. It sounds to me like we need a bit of a change in systemic thinking, right? Because shareholders demand this, and the reporting structures in most if we think about Western economies, that's how companies do this. How do we get beyond that?
Well, the case of VW, I think, is really instructive. And just today, in fact, the courts in the U.S. have slapped VW with a nearly $15 billion fine. I'm sure the good folks at the VW are asking themselves, how could they have possibly gotten themselves into this mess? How did they get themselves into this mess? Here comes that profit motive again, but it's more than that, and this is something else that we address in the book. We're addressing the idea of organizations having a conscience.
Okay.
If the management in VW and the organizational culture in VW really walk the walk and talk the talk, this never, ever would have happened, right? So the irony here is that they claim to be this green company. Mm-hmm. Right, and now it turns out, as a result of this whole mess, they're actually going to become a far greener company because they're going to be focused much more on electric cars, mm-hmm. which is great. It's too bad that it took this to come to that. But if this organization and many others had a conscience, said, you know what, this just isn't the right thing to do. We do want to be able to look ourselves in the mirror, after all. And you know what? Our shareholders, I'll bet, will also want us to do that. Mm. Think about that. They think that shareholders today necessarily only want to think about what the share price is. And of course, that's very important. Mm. But we've done research in the book that shows that people purchase products today looking at the packages, seeing what it's made of, seeing whether companies have green principles and abide by them, seeing if they believe in fair trade and things like that. And there was a study that was done in 2014 of a lot of people around the world, and it basically shows that over half of them purchase products based on whether companies abide by these principles. Now, if that was the case in 2014, by 2020, 2030, it's going to be the vast majority of consumers across the world. And in some parts of the world, for instance in Asia and in Latin America, it already is the majority. So it really is in a company's interests, if they aren't already doing the right thing, to start doing it. In VW's case, they would have saved themselves incredible headaches. They would have still had the reputation that they had. How do you do something about a ruined reputation once it's ruined? I mean, I don't know anyone personally who would want to buy a VW product today.
No.
And they did this to themselves. It was totally self-inflicted, right? So part of being globally risk agile, part of achieving organizational resilience, is having a conscience and doing the right thing. It's sort of like our mothers all taught us what to do, but suddenly when we get into the work world, either we forget about it or we don't remember that we ever learned it. And how many times can we think of instances where businesses have just plain been greedy? That's why we got into the mess we got into in 2008 and 9. It was all about greed, short-termism, lack of rigor in enforcing risk management practices, a whole host of things. That also was about not having a conscience. I look today at how far we have or have not gotten, the lessons we may or may not have learned since that time. And I must say, when I see legislation that has been put in place in the US and in Europe trying to be dismantled by lobbyists and special interests, I come to the conclusion that a lot of us haven't learned a darn thing.
The lobbying piece is very interesting. Actually, it also infuriates me because and quite possibly we could just bring it back to the Brexit piece, but we also have elections coming up in the United States. I think people are really fed up about whether or not leaders are representing the people or are accountable to people who have elected them, or to various special interests who've captured them. And my sense, and maybe the result of the vote we had last week is a representation of some of that, is that people are starting to really be fed up with it.
And this is a global phenomenon, mm-hmm. and as you know, it's not just Trump in the U.S., mm-hmm. right? And it's not just Marine Le Pen in France. Mm-hmm. It's Rodrigo Duterte yes. in the Philippines yes. and a whole host of other leaders which are emerging. It's the newly elected mayor of Rome who was a political outsider. People around the world are just fed up with the political class, with the status quo, with entrenched interests, and they're starting to show it. Mm-hmm. The concern that I have is that it seems like in some quarters all you have to have is the credential of being an outsider.
Yes.
Or being not part of the political class, and all of a sudden that's all you need to get catapulted to
yes.
office. It doesn't seem like there's much in the middle. It seems like it's feast or it's famine.
Yes.
When I think of a guy like Duterte, you know, for listeners who may not know much about him, I mean, he was the mayor for 20 years or so of a town in the southern Philippines called Davao. And it was a mess, and he really cleaned it up, but he did it by basically enforcing and participating in vigilante justice.
Yes, that's right. Death squads
any,
and...
Right, yeah. without any judicial process mm-hmm. to go along with it. And what the voters of the Philippines said earlier
let's
this
let's bring
year...
Let's make that countrywide, yeah.
Part of the reason they yeah. did that was that there was a 50% increase in crime in 2015 mm-hmm. in the country. And people just said, this is intolerable. Mm-hmm. But you have to ask yourself, what kind of a country do you want to live mm-hmm. in? And what kind of a country do you want people to
That's
think
right.
you are?
That's right.
Do you want people to think of your country as vigilante justice with no judicial system?
Well, this is...
I mean, my God.
Yeah, when you think about it, and if you get... You know, say you get into a dispute with your neighbor or something like that. Well, I think I'll just daub the guy in and say, well, he's a drug dealer, and which is the fear, right? And then the death squads go after him, and you start to get into effectively anarchy.
Well, effectively, what you have, based on what Duterte has already said, mm-hmm. is you don't need my permission. Just mm-hmm. go ahead.
Just
and
go ahead and
person.
Do it. Yeah,
right.
yeah. yeah. And what I find. Again, apologies for bringing back to the Brexit vote, because it's so much on my conscience and everyone's minds here. But there isn't an outlet for that kind of sentiment. There should be, and at the moment, the outlet in most places is a very destructive one, which is quite worrying. So let's elect this lunatic, or let's do this. Let's tear all this crap down. I don't care what the consequences are. I'm just fed up. And
you know, it's interesting. I have a friend who's a hedge fund guy mm-hmm. in Greenwich, Connecticut. I had lunch with him not long ago, and he's a Republican. Fine. Mm-hmm. He's going to vote for Trump. Fine. But then I asked him why. Mm-hmm. And here's a highly educated person mm-hmm. who reads, who knows the difference. And the only reason that he said he was going to vote for Trump is that he wanted change. Mm-hmm. Now, if that's representative of part of the voter class that is voting for a guy like
wow.
Trump, really, honestly, this man could get into power. Mm-hmm. Doesn't matter that some people think of him as a bigot and a racist and a misogynist mm-hmm. and, you know, just outrageous on mm-hmm. so many levels. And doesn't matter that it happens to be the United States mm-hmm. of America. It's just a very sort of indicative of the kind of times mm-hmm. that we're living in, where the entrenched interests and the 1% or the fraction of 1% and all of the people who have everything versus mm. the vast majority who have relatively little or almost nothing, I think they're finding their voice. In the Philippine example, you know, if you live as a very poor person in the Philippines, all you care about is your safety.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't matter to them, I don't think, if there's a judicial system or what other people think of the country. They're just wanting to be able to walk home without fear of getting killed. But what does it say about our societies and our world if it all boils down to something like that for the majority of people? It's a very sad statement.
Yes, indeed. So we certainly live in a world of high degree of man-made risk. A lot, all this stuff is self-inflicted, right? I'm interested in the decision-making part of your book. So
sure.
It implies that we've touched on it so far. We can do better, but we need to be a little bit more mindful, a little bit more careful, a little more inclusive, a lot more. So let's talk about decision making. Let's think about how, rather than just the self-destruct button is the best way to create the change and the volatility that we want. What about decision making?
So in the book, we're talking about a couple of different basic themes. One is on the individual leader level, that person needs to be reflective, needs to be self-critical, needs to be all the things that the organization ultimately is. Because at the end of the day, in most organizations, what goes on at the top floods down to the bottom.
Certainly. Yeah.
So we talk about, for example, the type of organization that doesn't mind if you bring your bike indoors so that it doesn't get stolen.
Right.
As opposed to one which forbids casual Fridays, right? What kind of a tone does something that basic, something that simple, set for individuals? What kind of a job are they going to do if they feel they work for an organization that doesn't mind about that stuff, that cares about the big picture items, right? That wants to keep their people happy? A good leader knows how to keep their people happy. A good leader sets the example him or herself, right? That's part of the issue. Another part of the issue, apart from the tone at the top, which is really important, is how organizations fit within the grander scheme of things. Are they leaders? Are they perceived to be leaders in so many areas? Do people want to be associated with companies that are judged to be the best places to work? And why are they judged the best places to work? A lot of it is because of employee empowerment and leadership having some insight into what makes their employees happy and therefore more productive. You know, again, this stuff is not rocket science. A lot of it's common sense. But how many companies that any of us have ever worked for, or organizations for that matter, can say that they worked for an organization that they felt was genuinely enlightened, where petty politics wasn't the issue, where, compulsory thought processes weren't prevailing, these types of things. How many of us wouldn't want to work for one of those top 10 companies? Virtually all of us would. How many of us ever will? Probably very few of us, because there's only so much capacity in those companies for people. But I would like to believe that in the age of instant communication, in the age where, we really don't have any excuses for not knowing what's going on in the world, for not caring about what's going on in the world, for not knowing the difference between right and wrong. We all do, even on an organizational level. How can we claim not to in this day and age? It's just impossible. So to me, decision making is all about doing the right thing, being honest with yourself, asking the right questions, asking your employees what they think, these types of things.
Okay. That's values are people in any organization, you've got their value statements either plastered on the wall, and there are sometimes sort of motherhood and apple pie statements. People, yeah, they're there, but I couldn't recite them, or I don't know. But I think what you're talking about is when you actually see examples of the kinds of behavior that it just isn't acceptable. Being able to call that out, whether you're a junior, you're more junior than someone, you could feel free to call someone out on it.
That's a really good point, Ben. I mean, how many organizations are people encouraged to blow the whistle?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the U.S. government rewards people who blow the whistle now, but they didn't for a long time, and it took a lot of issues to get to that point. But that really serves to illustrate that if you're working for the right type of company that's practicing the right type of leadership, you won't be afraid to speak up, and you certainly won't be penalized for it.
I'm not sure that we're there yet. I can't think of any specific examples of companies that are like that. I don't know if in the course of your research that you have a couple that are on your mind that are really good examples in this area.
The best known ones tend to come from the public sector, or
the
really, really bad ones, you know,
the
tobacco industry or what pharmaceutical industry, whatever the case may be. I wonder how much of those industries and sectors have actually substantially changed what they do or how they do it as a result. I don't have any way of knowing because I don't work for them, and that kind of information is not public, of course. But what I would say is those companies which never got in trouble in the first place, even though they're in an industry which is prone to trouble, are probably doing a lot of the right things.
Right.
Because the industry standard is probably something that you don't think may smell very good, you want to look the other way from. But if you're seeing it in the industry, but you're not seeing it in a given company, that's a really good indicator.
Yeah. One of the things that I find really interesting, and my last guest talked about this, and actually you have a company that's, I think, very similar in that. My last guest, Faisal Haq, who he's a CEO of an advisory firm, effectively, and he talks about the actual organization that he runs is relatively small, but the number of collaborators that he has, you know, is quite large, and that gives him, I think, and many others like yourself, perhaps, that have that model, quite a lot more reach and power. And I see younger people in the company I work with, they're kind of turning down the whole, you know, it's not all that prestigious to necessarily work for one of these sort of top 10 firms and have to sort of adapt to the culture and this idea of collaborative networks, smaller but more collaborative, perhaps more global, is perhaps another way of achieving that, of getting over that sort of short-termism, the challenges of having to kind of conforming, as long as it's sort of output based, and I'm right there as well. As long as it's output based and I'm doing what I, you know, what's expected of me, you know, that's fine. That should be cool. I shouldn't have to, you know, have show up at the office at 8:30 every morning and blah blah blah.
Well, there's a number of things to say about that. I think. People who are middle-aged or older might see that younger generation pursuing just what you described and think, well, is there a sense of entitlement there?
Yeah.
Why shouldn't they be paying their dues?
Yes.
By the same token, we're living in such an age with social media and apps and all this stuff where younger people they're just thinking differently than some of us did or had the opportunity to do when we were entering the workforce or through mid-career.
Yes.
I'd like to think that if I was 25 today, that I would probably be one of them. Mm-hmm. I would say, you know, I'm not sure I want to go into the corporate arena. I would much rather be an entrepreneur. I would much rather change the world or do something completely different, revolutionary.
Yeah.
I would encourage that to the extent that I can, hugely. There's a whole crop of people today who go to medical school and never become a doctor, go to law school and never practice law. It used to be the case that, you know, they maybe just couldn't find a job, and perhaps that there's still some of that today, given the dynamics of the job market. But a lot of people, I think, figure out after they've already paid those dues of going through that very painful process that it's just not what they want. But they have the courage to look themselves in the mirror and say, you know what? I know this is just not ideal. I'm hugely in debt. My parents are going to be very disappointed in me, etc. But they say, gosh, I really just have to look myself in the mirror. I can't sleep at night if I do this. And I applaud that. Mm. And I think the world's going to be a better place because it's going to be disruptive.
Mm-hmm.
Disruptive. Very important word. Very applicable to some of the themes in this book about being disruptive, encouraging disruption. But in a very, you know, sort of logical way, in a way that makes a lot of sense, rather than just being disruptive to be disruptive.
Sure, sure. And the same idea, I think, with becoming, you know, everybody wants to be, everyone under 25 wants to become an entrepreneur, et cetera, which is actually, I think, it's probably pretty hard to become an entrepreneur. It requires a lot of work.
90% of startups never
start up. That's right. So that's right.
You can bear that in mind.
So it's not all glamour. But I think in some respects we are all entrepreneurs as far as our careers and our career trajectories go. I'm not quite sure where I'm going with this, but the concept of disruption I think it's control. I was going to say something like controlled chaos within an organization. Controlled offense, is that the right word? When we just talked about being able to speak your mind and get things out on the table and contribute to the conscience of the organization.
This raises another interesting point, though. If you have the ability to speak your mind, would you have the courage to do so? And so, even at that bottom up level, part of the process which makes organizations more resilient and which makes leaders better leaders is presuming and knowing that if they give permission for people to do this, that they will actually do that. And that's a bit of a leap of faith, right? Because how many of us starting out would actually have the courage to do that, would potentially risk everything? Because there have been many stories of people at various stages of their career speaking out, and then they become radioactive and no
that's
one
right.
ever hires
well,
them again.
That's a problem with whistleblowers, particularly in the financial services sector. If you go down that route, you kind of can't get a job in the industry anymore.
In the industry, depending on who you blew your whistle on, whether it's a government, for example, no one will touch you. I actually know somebody who went through that process and... gosh, it's a real shame because he can't even make a living for his family in doing anything. A barista at Starbucks, that's about the only thing that he can get without having to think twice. That's about that, it.
Yeah, and what most people end up doing, and I was, again, another one of my guests, Alison Taylor, we had a chat about corruption, and you would just leave the organization, get another job, rather than stir the pot, which is probably what happens in 99.9% of the time. It's just that very rare exception in most places that we'll see it all through because it's incredibly draining and taxing.
Imagine what the world would be like if corruption wasn't a part of it. My God.
Yeah.
And, I'm fond of saying this, and it really is true. There really isn't virtually any country in the world that doesn't have that problem. Mm. I mean, a place like Singapore is one of the few, and some Scandinavian countries, etc. But I'm also mindful that in a place like the U.S., we're very good at criticizing other countries for their corruption problems, but ours is institutionalized and it's legalized. It's called how Washington works.
Yes.
Yeah. Right? Bernie Sanders has spoken a lot about this during the campaign, and he's absolutely right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But if it's a problem in the U.S., there's an element of that in the U.K., of course, virtually every developed country. I think any map that demonstrates, shows where corruption is in the world, I mean, if they're really being honest, there's got to include virtually every country in the entire world. Where would we be if that wasn't an issue, right? How much freer would people be to think the way they want? How many more resources would we have? How different would leaders be if that wasn't influence peddling and whatnot wasn't a consideration?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, dare to dream is all I can say. That's not the world we live in.
No, it certainly isn't. But how do you make improvements? And one of the things in a place like the United States, it really does feel like it's entrenched and institutionalized. whether it's the, you know, the dairy lobby or the, you know, tobacco lobby or what have you.
I think the founding fathers are spinning in their graves. This isn't exactly what they envisioned.
Yeah, yeah. For me, one of the things that's intriguing is, in many ways, smaller can be better. That if you've got more people that you see in either in an organization or maybe just in a system as peers versus, you know, people that I need to impress, or, you know, I don't want to speak out because what are they going to think of me? But if you just more think of, you know, peer-to-peer, which is going back to the city-state thing as well, but I think it's not quite the same. But if you, on that point, if I could just add, Ben,
think about what helps make the largest and most successful hedge fund in the world successful. It's a firm called Bridgewater, mm-hmm. happens to be in my state, Connecticut, mm-hmm. oddly enough. What they do is they flatten that curve mm. completely. Mm. They record every conversation mm. from anyone, senior okay. or group conversations, okay. whatever it may be. They videotape lots of things that go mm. on, and they are deliberately self-critical. They play it back. They say to everyone, what mm. could you have done differently? Mm. How did this interaction go? Part of the secret to their success is that they are so open mm. and that everybody's playing by the same rules. Mm. The CEO is recorded just like the most junior person on the team. Wow, what a model. Can you imagine if something like that was adopted mm-hmm. in more and more types of organizations, large and small? That would really flatten the curve out, wouldn't it?
Mm-hmm. It certainly would. I think that if you're able to speak to someone and you just think of, well, okay, you're just Daniel, right? And if you were my boss or the CEO or whatever, and people, I've worked for many years in the corporate environment. So when you get an opportunity to, so if you work in consulting, you get an opportunity to pitch at the so-called the C-suite. Oh my God, these people are super smart and super, you know, but also very intimidating, and they're going to ask, you know, tough questions. Some of them might be assholes, and, you know, and a lot of that goes on.
You know, it's interesting.
Versus just thinking, yeah. you're just a guy, and I'm telling you something, and you're gonna, you know, give
there
me your
impression.
There is
that point of view, and there is also the realization that a lot of the boards, which ultimately make the final decisions in organizations today, they're composed of friends of CEOs.
Oh, they are. Yeah,
they're entities and individuals.
It's a very small
rubber
club.
Stamp things. Mm. And a lot of them have no idea mm. what questions they should even be mm. asking. I'm fond of saying, this is something that I noted in my previous book, Managing Country Risk, that one of the board members of Lehman Brothers mm-hmm. was the great-granddaughter of E.F. Hutton, who was one of the mm. original founders. And this woman was 83 years old at the time that Lehman Brothers mm. imploded back mm. in 2009. You have to ask the question, now what mm. possible value could this mm. woman have been adding to the board and the decision-making process? She was a former actress. She was 83 years old. She'd never been in the corporate arena other than her role in this board.
My God.
Where's the value addition yes. on that? And sadly, I don't think that kind of example is very different than what we would see in many, many boardrooms across the world today.
I think you're right, and you come across the same names, the same. You know, I've got friends from all over the world, and you explain this phenomenon in one country, and they turn around and say, you know, my country is exactly the same, which is, I think, opposite of what we just talked about. I mean, I think to get to a place where people are free to speak their minds. And we've got a culture of shared values. As you say, we need to flatten the curve. We need to think about peers and collaborators versus hierarchies and a sense of entitlement around it.
Organizations are going to be much better off if they adopt that kind of approach.
I agree.
But
I
how
agree.
Many of them are brave enough to do it?
My
hope ultimately is that the tables will turn. And it will be incumbent mm. upon leaders' organizations to do this kind of stuff, because if they don't, because the majority might be doing that, they'll be falling further and further mm-hmm. behind. This is, of course, decades, I suppose, in the making.
I think so.
But one of the reasons why we think this is an important book is that now is a pivotal moment in history for so many different reasons. Mm-hmm. And we just think that there is no time like the present to mm-hmm. start getting things right or making things right. And when we're talking about the intersection of man-made and natural risk like never before, in what we call the Anthropocene era, mm-hmm. where man interferes in the environment, and that is occurring as never before, and it has implications like never before. That being the case, you know, if you look throughout history, you look, go back 4.5 billion years, look at the crustaceans through the dinosaurs to where we are, we're a little blip in that history, right? And we like to think of ourselves as
we have a hugely self-important approach to things.
We are just a little blip on the radar.
The world
screen.
Is made for us. Everything we can control everything, and when you put it in those terms.
But what we're doing today, Ben, really has potentially profound implications for generations to come. Mm. That's why it's so very important for each of us to become more cognizant of where we are in time, mm-hmm. where we are in the Anthropocene era, what the potential implications for not acting are, what the potential implications are for not acting enough, mm-hmm. not caring enough, not doing enough, etc. And, you know, I'm not saying this because I'm some tree-hugging liberal. I'm mm-hmm. actually not. Mm-hmm. I'm saying this as someone, in my co-author Dante also believes this, that, you know, we care very much about the future. We care very much about people and organizations and countries, and we want everyone to succeed. It's in everybody's interest to get a grip on this stuff, and mm-hmm. we're just hoping that somehow this book can make some kind of mm-hmm. difference.
Well, I certainly look forward to reading it when it comes out, and I would urge all of my listeners to do the same, because it sounds very important, and it sounds like you've got a different take on all of this stuff that, you know, we hear the same sorts of things, and the same sorts of buzzwords get wheeled out. But my conversations really intrigued me about this, I'm really looking forward to it coming out. So you told me earlier there's a website for the book.
Yes, it's called globalriskagility.com.
Perfect.
And it's already on Amazon.
Perfect.
And a few other sites, and the reviews are on the site, and people can see what others have said about it.
So you've already got some reviews up.
We've got 10 reviews up from some really, knowledgeable and influential people, such as the first Homeland Secretary mm-hmm. in the United States, Tom Ridge, a guy named Georg Kell, who created the UN Global Compact, a former Marine general, a whole bunch of different mm-hmm. people.
So. Not your not hippies and entry huggers at all, actually.
None of them actually fall into that category.
Yeah, which in and of itself is really that's really interesting, because I think some concepts that the way people who are really leading edge are thinking and talking, it doesn't sound like what you normally hear. It does sound more hippie-ish and little bit more out there. But when you think, just like this book in our conversation, when you actually think about what they're saying, it makes a lot of sense.
It all boils down to common sense for the final time. It boils down to not forgetting what your mm-hmm. parents taught mm-hmm. you, knowing the mm-hmm. difference between right and wrong, mm-hmm. but thinking about it in the context of big picture mm-hmm. issues, right? Like all of our collective future and how companies survive and how they thrive and how the dynamics of so much of the world are actually in flux, currently changing. We need to be mindful and cognizant of all that stuff.
Well, sounds great. It sounds like a wonderful place to end it as well. I want to thank you for coming back on my show. And as I said, really look forward to the book coming out. And again, urge my listeners to check it out. Any other final thoughts?
No, I just want to thank you for having me back. And I think that most anyone will benefit greatly from taking a look at the book.
Perfect. Thanks, Daniel. A huge thank you to Daniel for coming back on the show once again. That was great. And I'd like you to think about what Daniel says about common sense
And if you read the book, if you pick up the book, and by the way, I urge you to go and pick up a copy of the book or the audiobook, which I've done. But if you have a look at the book, you'll note that there's a whole section about simplifying the complex. And these kinds of things, simplification, using common sense, all of that stuff sounds easy, but it is incredibly hard to do. And I think that applies to our own lives, not just organizations and societies. And if you just think about how difficult it is to simplify or explain something that's very complicated, you'll know that takes a lot of hard work. So there's a lot of work to be done. And I think that the book, The Global Risk Agility and Decision Making, gives us a great start along that path. There's some wonderful recommendations in it. So check it out. GlobalRiskAgility.com is the book's website. The book is available on Amazon. The link is in the show notes, so do check that out. Finally, if you liked this episode, and if you like the show, do us a big favor and leave a rating or a review on iTunes, or both. It takes just a few seconds, but what that does is it helps the show, it helps people discover the show by bumping it up on various lists that iTunes generates. Share the show on social media, anything else, that kind of stuff really helps us out. And if you have any feedback, you can send it to me via email. allthingsrisk@gmail.com is the best place to do that. Check out allthingsrisk.com, which is the website. Give me a follow on Twitter at @riskthings is the handle. Ladies and gentlemen, that's all for now. Have a great week, and we'll be back with another episode next week. In the interim, don't forget, risk is life.